Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
Basically, the story is a break in play where the midfielder reflects on his past career. And he's had a good career. He's played professional football throughout his life. So it's a kind of a real fantasist story from my point of view, because I never played at that level.
Welcome all. It is episode 71 of Behind the Lines here on 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Irish writer Adrian Duncan. Adrian is originally from Longford, but is now based in Berlin, working as a visual artist. He's also a writer of growing renown, and last year became the inaugural winner of the John McGahern Annual Book Prize, and in 2019 was shortlisted for the Doki Literary Emerging Writer Award. He has written two novels, Love Notes from a German Building Site and A Sabbatical in Leipzig, and now he has a delightful collection of short stories titled Midfield Dynamo. A quick reminder to get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. But now, on with our conversation with Adrian Duncan. Adrian Duncan, thanks so much for doing the show. How are you?
Very well now, very well indeed.
I think we need to start with your storied football career. I didn't realise that you played and lit up a year at Longford Town. Can you tell us about your football career before we get to the art?
I can. It's an extremely short and mediocre story, but I'll tell it anyway. So I was kind of, when I was in, I went to primary school and secondary school in Ballymahan, which is a sort of medium-sized town, southern county Longford. And it was sort of 80s, early 90s. And in my primary school, soccer was essentially banned. So if we were caught playing soccer with the ball would be taken off us. So there was a sort of trick we used to play whenever we'd hear of one of the teachers coming around the corner. We'd say, right, pick the ball up and start playing Gaelic. So we'd start kicking the ball over the bar and all that kind of stuff. So there was no real soccer culture when I was growing up. So I'd just do the normal stuff out the front of houses, keepy-uppies and, you know, crosses and all that kind of stuff. So I loved soccer, but there was no way to actually play it really in Ballymahan. Now, you could have gone into Longford and that kind of stuff, but that wasn't really available to me at the time. So I didn't really play soccer that much until I went to university when I was 17. I went to university over in Scotland. Over in Aberdeen, I studied engineering there. So I was originally studying the structural engineering. And when I was there, I went over and I'd been playing with the minor team, the Ballymahan minor team the summer before. And so I went over to Aberdeen pretty fit and I was, you know, young and I was able to have reasonable coordination, that kind of stuff. So there was this big trial where all of the new students in Aberdeen went up to about 8 different pitches up in the outside of the city. And there must have been about 150 lads all playing games. And the manager of the university team was walking around and kind of whittling down, you know, taking the ones that he liked out. And at the end of the day, there was about 4 of us picks out of that lot. We were the 4 who sort of stood out. And 2 of us were put into the first team and 2 of us were put into the second team. So myself and this chap studying, what was he studying? Oh, yeah, he was studying pharmacology. Liverpoolian fella. He'd been on the books of Crewe Alexandria when he was young, so he could play a bit. But he obviously wasn't good enough to make it at Crewe. So he went to study up in Aberdeen. So me and him, Mikey Mason and I, were picked to go with the first team. The next week then we were playing outside of Aberdeen in a kind of one of those kind of local leagues, a pretty good standard, but nothing, not I would say below semi-professional. And I started playing and it became very, very obvious very, very quickly to the manager that I actually didn't know how to play any position. I was fit and I could run and I was coordinated, but I didn't actually understand how the game worked. I didn't know how a right winger played. I didn't know any of that kind of stuff. So within about 2 or 3 games, I was put down into the second team. And I more or less stayed between the first team and the second team for the next 3 years in Aberdeen. Never really establishing myself in the first team and doing okay in the second team. But I learned a little bit of how football actually, how the actual team works, the, you know, how an actual different formations behave in terms of how a right winger drops in to help the in defense and how they move forward and or hug the wing or whatever it is. This would have been completely new to me at the time when I was 17. So I was kind of on a very steep learning curve. The other thing that was really strange at the time was that I'd come from a rural Irish dressing room. And an underage dressing room in rural Ireland is a very, very different thing to a soccer dressing room in a city. Where a lot of the fellas you'd be playing with had been let go by you know, places like Celtic or Dunfermline or these kind of things. So they all had these kind of rituals that I associate with a sort of Victorian kind of way of living. So they had, before every game, you know, the boots would be cleaned and the dobbin would be put on the boots and all this kind of stuff. And for me, this was, I just turned up with my boots covered in kind of mud from the last game, because Gaelic footballers aren't so interested in that kind of, those kind of rituals. So all of this stuff was just so startlingly new to me at the time. So after 4 years of that, I'd learned a good bit about football, and I'd come out reasonably fit and knowing a little bit about the game. And I moved back to Ireland essentially to get a job, because I was finished my engineering degree. So I got a job up in Dublin, up in Irish Rail, up in Dublin. And around this time, Stephen Kenny had taken over at Longford Town. I think he'd taken over for about a year. And Mickey Cox was the chairman still at the time. And they were doing well, and they had a reserve team and they had a first team. And I went in, I said that I'd like to sign or I'd like to try out or whatever. So because I was living in Dublin, Stephen Kenny said to me, sure, look, come out and you can train with us in Dublin. Now, when I say Dublin, really it was Selbridge. And when I say it was a training pitch, it really was a patchily lit, an extremely muddy square of grass down at the bottom of a driving range. So there was two little spotlights on it, and it was rough and you could barely see. And every now and then a golf ball would plop beside you from the driving range, about over 250 yards up the way.
You're not like those people in The Simpsons training with like mattresses tied to their back in case you get hit by flying golf balls, obviously.
I mean, you know, it wasn't a million miles. I mean, if we were any closer to the driving range, that would have entirely been okay. But no, it was absolutely amazing because there was a guy called Christy Mann, who I think played for Shelburne back in the day and St. Pat's. And he was essentially the trainer and Stephen Kenny was the manager. And some of the players that I remember there were Vinnie Perth was there, young Vinnie Perth. Paul McNally, who eventually played for Bohemians. Wes Byrne was another one who had come back from Middlesbrough. There's a guy called Robert O'Connor who played up front. He was absolutely superb. He had come up from the Leinster Senior Leagues. And a guy called Shea Zeller, he was playing there as well. And Evan Creedon. I'm just naming a few that I can remember now. But I remember them all, the atmosphere at these. So we train every Tuesday and Thursday. And I was by far, when I arrived first, I was, even though I'd done okay in Aberdeen or whatever with university, when I arrived up with the Longford Town lads, I was by far the worst. I mean, I was way off it in fitness and in terms of just speed of thought and in terms of adapting to changing situations and all that kind of stuff. So it took me, I was on another very, very steep learning curve there. And I'm sure any of them listening to this won't remember me. You know, they absolutely will not, because I wouldn't have made any kind of an impression on it. But I was utterly engrossed in this and I was totally focused and all that kind of stuff. And what was interesting was, because the training conditions were so bubbly and so muddy and so poorly lit, that then at the weekends, when the lads actually did go out onto a pitch under floodlights that was in perfect condition, they were playing superb, absolutely superb football, really, really direct, really, really fast, and full of goals, which was weird, which was strange for Longford Town to have a team that was full of goals. There's a guy called Richie Parsons played as well. He was kind of the elder statesman of the team, but he knocked in a load of goals that season. And it was the season that Longford Town went up from the First Division. I think they finished either first or second in the First Division that season, but they went up anyway to the Premier Division. But over the course of that 9 months or so, I just learned an awful lot about of how to play football. And one thing that I learned was that, and I saw this from Vinnie Perth mostly, was that when the ball was coming towards him, he wasn't necessarily picking out the pass that he was going to hit immediately. He was picking out the pass that would happen after that. So who would be in the best position to hit the best pass after that? And it was this weird kind of forward thinking that has a type of intelligence that I had never seen before, but that is incredible. Absolutely incredible thing to see at such speed and at such a sort of improvisational way. So, and I also realized the different types of responsibilities that a central midfielder has to, say, a left back and a center half. And I was also really interested to see what an actual central midfielder can see relative in terms of what this left back can see or the goalkeeper can see and all that kind of stuff. So I was mostly playing for the reserve team through this. It was really, really interesting because we got to play in some brilliant football grounds against other reserve teams. So we used to, because we were in Leinster, essentially, we'd be playing St. Pat's. So I played in Richmond Park, even though I scarcely deserved it. I played in Dalymount Park against Bohemians. I remember we beat them 2-1. Paddy Collins was on the line, actually. That was under lights, but I was just awestruck playing on Dalymount Park. I played left back that day. I remember there was a guy called a fella Doherty from Longford. I think he always talked about wanting to be a hairdresser. He had a brilliant game that night. He was superb. And I played also Carlisle grounds and all these different grounds that are like, you know, really, really beautiful little stadia around Leinster. And it was a real privilege to play on those parks, even though I still don't think I really deserved it. But anyway, I can't have been that bad. Maybe I'm being a bit harsh myself. So then about maybe 2/3 of the way through the season, there was a League Cup game, I think it was. And because they were making a push for the league, Stephen wanted to rest a few of the real, real first team players for the League Cup game. So he decided to bring in a few of us reserve team players. And I was absolutely delighted to be one of them. So we were playing Home Farm up in Whitehall under lights on a Tuesday night. And I remember we went over to the Skylawn Hotel at about maybe 1 o'clock in the day and we had some sandwiches. So like, this is the things, even though there was very little money, Stephen got all of these small things right, just to make sure that the atmosphere was good leading up to the game and that everyone felt in it and that, you know, the things were being done properly and you're being looked after, even though there really wasn't a huge amount of money available. So anyway, we went out and played that game and I didn't start the game, which I was disappointed at. I really felt I was in the running for a starting, but I didn't. And I came on at halftime as a halftime substitute for Jimmy Farrell, who was a Longford footballer who was playing up front. He wasn't having a great game that night. And I came on and I did okay. And I was I came onto the middle of the field and there was another midfielder there. He was, I cannot remember his name, but he was big. He couldn't really run very fast, but it was impossible to get the ball off him. And he had that smarts. He could see passes. He could just hold you off with a nudge of his hip and then the ball would be pinged 20 yards, totally different direction, setting some winger off. You know, he was a really brilliant footballer. But I remember really vividly that night, there was a very young footballer playing up front called Richie Foran. And even though he was probably the youngest fella on the pitch, I think he was on loan from Shelburne or something like that, he terrorized us. He was so strong, so fast, so direct. And he scored 2 goals as well. And you could just see in him that this guy had really something else to him. He was like a really, even at that young age, he was kind of a cut above, you know. So that was really kind of that was my high point of my career, was that game against Home Farm. And I remember in the near 2/3 of the way through the second half, I got the ball in midfield and I passed it back to the right wing back, a fella called Flanagan, I think it was. And then I turned and another midfielder came and replaced me and I kind of went in behind him. And this Flanagan guy, I can't remember his first name, sort of hit this lovely cultured pass up into the middle of the pitch. And the midfielder came across, it was Patter Malone. He flicked it on and it span out in front of me and I ran onto it. I remember my legs were clipped and I knew I was like, I should have gone down there, would have got a free kick. But I just kept on my feet. And I just kind of slid towards the end line and crossed the ball as I went over. And I remember Shea Zeller headed the ball and it was handled on the line. We got a penalty, we scored, we went 3-1. It was completely unimportant. And then about, whatever, 15, 16 years later, I was sitting outside a cafe in Berlin and I was working on a short story and I'd been reading a lot of, there's this Dutch-Austrian author called Thomas Bernhard. And I'm a big fan of his writing. He goes on these really extended rants about classical music because he was a classically trained musician himself. And I was sitting there outside the cafe and I was kind of, what? I mean, one thing that struck me about Bernhard was like, he really seems to enjoy writing these big, long rants. Even though he sounds angry, he must enjoy doing it. And I thought to myself, what do I know about in as much depth and with as much sort of lived experience as he does? And I was like, I could do engineering, but I was writing another book about engineering, the Love Notes from a German Building Site. So instead I said, well, sure, why don't I write about football? I know a lot about football. I've been following it since I was 6. I've been playing it, all that kind of stuff. So I sat down and in about 3 or 4 hours, I wrote essentially the first drafts. I went to 2 cafes and I wrote the first draft of this short story, Prozanecki, which is told from the center circle of a football pitch somewhere in the north of England. Let's say Sheffield or somewhere like that. And it basically, the story is a break in play where the midfielder reflects on his past career. And he's had a good career. He's played professional football throughout his life. So it's a kind of a real fantasist story from my point of view, because I never played at that level. And he, over the course of this, he sort of thinks back on his influences as a footballer, and he thinks of this brilliant footballer who I'm sure everyone knows, Robert Prozinecki, who was originally a Yugoslavian footballer, but then obviously after the breakup of Yugoslavia, became a Croatian footballer. And he, to me, was just a superb footballer for Red Star Belgrade in the that young team that won the European Cup in the, or the, it was UEFA Cup, European Cup, in the 1990-91 season, when they beat Marseille. And then they broke up, and then all of these players were sent to all over Europe. Dejan, so Stojkovic, Savicevic, all these, and Mihailovic, all these players. And Prozinecki himself ended up in Barcelona. He also ended up in Sociedad, and he also ended up in Madrid. But injuries hampered his career, but he was an absolutely superb footballer. And this fictional character of mine also thought he was a superb footballer and based his footballing style on him. And in the story, he realizes that actually he's misinterpreted everything that Prozinecki was doing, and that's sort of the nuts and bolts of the story itself. But the last section of the story, then, it kind of goes back into action, and it's a kind of retelling of what I encountered when I played for Longford Town against Home Farm, whatever, 15, 20 years ago. So that's where all of that comes from.
The writing is so good. Like, we had Prozinecki, this story was featured on the show. Previous, actually, was picked by Ty Coakley a few months ago, and I'd read it. It had been in Stinging. It had been published in Stinging Fly, I think, before it was included in your collection. I am going to read a bit of it because it is. I just love it. It's so excellent. A silence comes over me as I take a touch, but the touch is terrible and has put me too wide, and the ball has gone too long, and my right leg has been clipped, and I should really go to ground, and I can hear the crowd scream for me to do so as if nothing would make them happier. But to my left, I glimpse our striker powering alone into the box, and if I can dink the ball across to him, he will surely score. I know, too, that if I fall, I will be reconnected with my past, so I straighten, and my legs, out of dumb momentum, begin to gather and re-coordinate beneath me, and I realise that if I propel myself and stretch for this disappearing ball and dink it back across the box, that somehow I will have done enough. I lunge feet first and scissor my right foot desperately at the base of the ball. As I connect and slide over the line, I can see the ball spinning handsomely back up and away from me towards a space in front of our striker, whose eyes and mouth have widened, his arms have spread, his feet have skipped, his knees are bent, and he lifts himself diagonally up to where my cross is going. The ball slows into its languid arc, and as his body coils and his eyes wince shut, bringing him into the great pre-impact dark that every footballer knows, I gasp deeply once more at the impotent, incidental, and unforgivable beauty of it all. That's so excellent. Maybe the crowd screaming is the only real bit of artistic license there, because I don't know how many people were there to watch Home Farm against Longford of Whitehall. You mentioned, like, okay, so Robert Prozinecki, one of his former teammates, is aforementioned Dragan Stojkovic, and he is the new Serbia manager and spent a portion of last month on a touchline with Stephen Kenny. Can you ever imagine that Stephen Kenny has gone from coaching you and others at the end of a driving range in Selbridge to the Republic of Ireland national job?
You know, it is funny you should say that, because there was a feeling amongst people, particularly after the first season or two with him there, that this guy was definitely going to go on and do something really, really interesting and special in the game if things went well for him. There was a feeling that he would do really, really well. He had this. He's an extremely nice man. That's the first thing. And I think the players, certainly from what I saw, they wanted to do well for him. You know. They would run through walls for him. That was the kind of sense. And I think that's, I think it is like a surprise that perhaps that he has got the Ireland job as soon as he has, but there was definitely a feeling that he would do very well. And I felt when he went to Dunfermline, I thought he was so close to succeeding there, because we brought them to a Scottish Cup final, and they only just got relegated a game or two from the end. I think it was a goalkeeping mistake that really put them down. And if he had somehow saved Dunfermline from going down that season and got them to that cup final, which he did, things could have turned out an awful lot differently for him in terms of his career in Britain. But then he came back and he just excelled again in Derry and excelled again completely in Dundalk. Like, he was absolutely superb up in Dundalk. And I think he deserved the right to be given the Ireland position. And I think if he's given time, I think he will actually do something very, very interesting there. And I think he's sort of different to the previous managers because a lot of them were sort of corporate appointments, i.e. get us to the World Cup no matter what. It doesn't matter what the football looks like. We have to get there because we need the money. Whereas now it's all out in the open. We know how ruined our finances are, as the FAI's finances are. So to go down that corporate football route of like, get us there no matter what, that doesn't matter anymore. And I think there should be room for an approach like Stephen's. And it should be given room. And I think it should be given time as well. And I hope he is given time because I really do still believe he'll do something. And as he said himself, that he's working on trying to produce a team that the country can be proud of. And that doesn't mean winning all the time. It partly means winning. But it means actually playing the game in a way that's not utterly cynical. And I think one thing that Stephen was also very, very good at, and it'd be very interesting to see if he can pull this off with Ireland, he was very good at engaging the supporters and the people around the club in the club. And of course, a national team is a totally different proposition. But I think his skills in that will be tested, and it'll be very interesting to see if he can pull it off, i.e. to bring the public into the orbit of the team. And I think by playing good football, that will certainly help, you know. So I'm still very hopeful for him.
Mm. Yeah. Tell us a story about the Stephen Kenny you remember. What stirs in your mind when you see him on a touchline now?
Well, one thing that he was really, really, that I found that he was really good at was when before a game, he'd always come in and he'd always say something slightly disarming. So like say in the group sense, he'd say something like, you know, you all look great, lads. Something like that. And it was like something like aesthetic that was totally what like, you know, go out and hammer this lot. It was something that had kind of, that gave you sort of like, you're like, oh yeah, that as well, you know? And also like whenever I was say, certainly from the few contacts I had with him when I was playing for the reserve team, he'd sort of take you aside every now and then. And he just knew what to say to you. So like with me, for instance, I remember I was playing a game against Athlone Town, the reserves, and there was a young, smaller midfielder playing with me, a guy called Wayne Fitzell. He was very skillful. I think he played for UCD before that. He'd had a very bad leg break. And I remember Stephen just walking me across the pitch and just kind of saying, you know, you're his big brother in there today. You look after him and all this kind of stuff. And like looking back on it, you know, you're kind of, it's not that complicated stuff, but he knew there wasn't any point in him telling me to, you know, do something technically very interesting or brilliant, but that I could actually do something in the game by, you know, say imposing a certain, posing myself, say, or by say protecting another person or whatever. So he had he seemed to me to have a very, very strong sort of reading of people and how to actually communicate with them as well. And I think they say that a lot about really good managers, that they know how to man-manage. And I think that's become, in more recent years, the better that you can man-manage, the more successful I think you can be. And I think he definitely had that even then, even though I didn't really know what was going on when it was going on. It's only just looking back on it now. So those are the kind of, it was those two things that he'd just surprise you with stuff he'd say every now and then. And then he'd... The taking you aside and giving you time, it was like, yeah, you'd really want to do it for him then, you know. It was that kind of just encouragement, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. And that what you mentioned, like he would talk about something aesthetic, like you look great today. I guess that's to build up confidence. And it also comes from, like, it comes out of left wing, like.
Yeah. I remember like we were, I can't remember who we were about to play. We were going out and I think we got a new kit or something like that. And it was a white kit. And we did look really nice. It was very, very, we did look really good. But it was like, I was just utterly surprised. And this idea of aesthetics in football to me is extremely interesting because it goes through football, you know, not just like things like the graphic design or the designs of your club colours or whatever, or your club shield. Like all that stuff is just deeply, deeply interesting to me. And also like the way in which, like, and this sense of aesthetics, this sense of like, who is football for, you know? That to me is a really, really interesting question. And it's one that comes up in Prozanecki. It's like when you're playing, you know, are you hitting beautiful passes because, or are you hitting a pass because it's effective? Or are you hitting a pass because it's beautiful and it'll get the crowd on its feet and that has an effect? And I often think, like, I look at, say, Roy Keane's passing from when he was in his pomp, and none of it is necessarily aesthetically beautiful. It's more like a sort of a boxer jabbing. Just jabbing, a really effective jab, just this ball that keeps on cutting through two or three people into feet on the turn. And he was, if you think of an effective passer, he has to go down as one of the most effective passers in the UK game in the last, whatever, 20 years. But in terms of a highlights reel, you'd almost never see one of his passes on it. It's always sort of this idea of, say, like a Steven Gerrard thing. And I have this controversial opinion, certainly an opinion that that my friends find controversial, we always disagree with, that Gerrard actually wasn't all that great a player because he too often chose the less effective but more handsome pass. And that actually, to kind of liken him to Scholes or to Keane or these sort of players, is a sort of, it's like apples and oranges. It's completely the sort of, it's completely sort of a wrong kind of an analogy. And I think the reason, that's one of the very good reasons why Liverpool never won a league with Gerrard, because he didn't have that kind of psychotic jabbing that was required by the midfielders in Man United, who just said, we don't care really how this looks. We want to pass this ball past three players and break those lines. And if you break the lines over 70 minutes or 80 minutes or 90 minutes, you're going to score goals. It's as simple as that, you know? So that relationship between pragmatism or use and aesthetics happens on the pitch and all of these other things. And I find that really, really fascinating. And more recently than the aesthetics of VAR, I think I wrote a piece for Yee a couple of months back about whoever said football should be fair. And like, I still completely believe that. And I think that VAR is one of the worst impositions on football. And I think it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But I think it's an absolutely terrible step, because it suggests that football should be fair, that it should somehow be accountable to other people. And it's like, I don't think it should be. I think it should be unfair, because there's lots of different reasons why it should be unfair. First of all, it's a game for human beings. So the referee is in that flux, interpreting and enacting rules. The players are trying to fool the referee. The players are trying to play fairly, whatever it is. And all of these things, I think, are part of what it is to be human. And there's errors. Of course there's errors. It's a game, you know? But also I think that grievance is a really important part of football. So when you're like, I'm really annoyed, that was an injustice, that event. So let's say, for instance, the one that I think binds every single Irish player of our generation is Thierry Henry's handball. We'll never forget it. But it's a grievance that lasts, and that will last for probably another 15 or 20 years, and it'll be talked about for another 15, 20 years. And that's something that connects supporters, and it connects generations of supporters. And I think that's important. And I think it's more important than these things of stopping a game, killing a game, auditing a game, reviewing a game. And then sort of some kind of, after some sort of corporate audit, the whole thing is sort of okayed to proceed. To me, this is a horrible step in the aesthetics of the game and in the values of the game, you know? And it's not just teething problems. It's the actual idea of it, you know? It's the actual idea of it, that somehow unfairness is no longer acceptable. It's like, what a crazy, crazy thought, you know?
Yeah. To briefly go back to what you mentioned, like the line in the Prosinecki story is that the pragmatic serves the aesthetic. And it's true. I read it and obviously spent some time thinking about it afterwards. Like, it is true. Like, because the best players of this generation are the numbers machines, like Messi and Ronaldo, and everything they say, everything they do. I don't particularly find too much beauty or art in what Ronaldo does, but I do find in what Messi does. And they do it because it's the most effective thing that they do. There was a documentary about football on Amazon, like This Is Football or something. It was a bit uneven, but there's a really interesting bit at Barcelona, because they have this head of methodology and they're teaching kids in the academy about Messi and how he moves. And he said the reason that he can manipulate the ball and manipulate the people around it so easily is that he moves more often than anyone else. And they dig up an example of a goal he scored against Real Madrid, where he shimmies the ball around Casemiro and then buries the ball in the bottom corner. And they slow it down, and they show that because Messi doesn't lift his feet as far off the ground as other people when they move, it allows him to make more steps and more movements. So he makes five movements. His feet touch the ground five times in the time that it takes Casemiro to make a single step. I was like, God, that, like, just breaking it down, that is so interesting. And that, like, there's nothing more pragmatic than that, than just allowing yourself make as many movements as you possibly can.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the thing about Messi, that he has that extraordinary blend of that kind of, you know, when the ball arrives at his feet, he kind of surveys the landscape before him, and he makes really direct and pragmatic decisions, but they just happen to be also extremely beautiful. And I think that's what raises him above, you know, most other players, because there's no way you could argue he's not effective. Everything is effective. I mean, certainly up until maybe the last year or whatever, but in his absolute pomp, he was astonishingly effective, you know. I think in some players, that relationship between the beauty of what they do and the actual decision-making and the pragmatism of what they're at is just a little bit more obvious, you know. I think that's why I love trying to sort of compare these midfielders, like say Keane and Gerrard and that kind of thing. And more recently, let's say maybe you could even say like Foden more recently, even though he's kind of very much an attacking midfielder. But I think that and also this has a sort of an impact on, you know, what moves a section of supporters and what is it that draws them to, you know, and why are they then a Barcelona fan or whatever? Why are they, you know, is that part of the culture of the team, that kind of stuff? And I find all of that kind of the relationship between how a team plays, you know, like, and how the current crop play and the relationship that has with their colours and their supporters and all of these histories that connect and the places that connect them. I find that fascinating. Like last year, I was traveling up and down through, before the COVID lockdown, I was traveling up and down through England. I was working on a film and I was recording sound at football matches. So I went to Lincoln City, who were playing Portsmouth. And then I went back down to Portsmouth, who were playing Lincoln City. And I was hoping that Portsmouth would sing Prosinecki songs because it was for a film that related to that Prosinecki story. They didn't. They didn't sing any Prosinecki songs. But what I found really interesting was down at the Portsmouth Fratton Park was that the sound coming off the stands was really different to the sort of sound I was getting off the much newer Lincoln City Park, name of which I can't remember. Because the Fratton Park one is one of those old stadia designed by that Alistair Leach, the guy who designed the Tynecastle and the old Aston Villa Park and all those, and Fulham and all these really, really old and now listed buildings. But Fratton Park was really, really interesting because you're surrounded by these kind of, it's like a sort of giant kind of industrial ironworks. And within it, there's all of these kind of repeated Victorian patterns and rituals. And then these songs, and there's this kind of unionization that connects all of the people and they know the words. And it's just extraordinary. And I found it really, really, really interesting recording sound there and listening to the lifts and the lilts of the singing. And then when something happens on the pitch, that just penetrating the songs and you get a roar. And it's a really, really beautiful thing to listen to. It has its own kind of rhythms. And when you're listening to it back, independent of anything on the pitch, just on your own, in your own headphones, there's a sort of strange visualization that goes on when you listen to it back. It's really quite lovely, you know, actually just listening to a crowded football pitch and picking all the little bits and pieces of shouts and people being annoyed or delighted or whatever. Just going back to the Prosinecki short story in relation to that, I listened to a lot of footballing podcasts as well. I find the stories and the narratives in these podcasts, particularly of ex-players, you know, just absolutely fascinating. Or just reading a quick Wikipedia of some unknown player who maybe played in the second division all his life or whatever. I find these things really, really interesting. I remember I was looking at one podcast, this guy called Cy Ferry over in Scotland who does Open Goal. And he basically invites players who might have played in Scotland or Scottish players to kind of talk about their career, essentially. An hour and a bit usually. And I remember I came across one chat and he was talking about it was half time and I think it was Simon Ferry. He was a substitute and he was sitting inside, you know, putting on his studs or whatever. And all of the team had gone out. And the manager had said to the centre midfielder, you know, don't be getting sent off. I need you out there for the whole second half, et cetera, et cetera. And then within about a couple of minutes, a roar went up and the guy who had been told not to get sent off came back into the changing room. And he'd been sent off. And I just found that situation, you know, you're sitting in a changing room underneath a stand with loads of people roaring at a game outside. And I found that situation of a player returning from hell and another player preparing to go to heaven. I found that to be a really interesting existential situation or scene. And I was just, when I heard it, or that version of it I heard on a podcast, I was like, oh, I'd really, really like to involve that in a short story. So then when my editor and I were working on Prosonecki, so the version in Sting and Fly, it starts on the pitch. And my editor said, I think we should start this a little bit earlier. So he said, why don't you try the subs bench or something like that? And I said, I know what I'll do. I'll bring him into the changing room and we'll do it there. So I really enjoyed actually just writing that, and the idea of these sounds and this singing and this joy and this fervor being above you, but that you can't see. I just found that like really, really interesting. So all of those things just kind of come together. It's just a fascination with not just the game, but all of the structures and constructions around it, you know?
Let's talk about the structure of the stories in Midfield Dynamo. You've arranged them in a 1-4-4-2 formation, including the goalkeeper there, which is you're ahead of the rest of us in Ireland in listening like that. So you chose a field position for each story based on the personality I perceived from it, is what you write in the introduction. Can you explain that a little bit to us?
I can, yeah. So I spent the last maybe 12 years writing these short stories. So some of them have nothing to do with football, and some of them football appears and drifts out or that kind of thing. So I've been writing them for the last 12 years, and for the last maybe up until last March when I started editing the whole thing together, I had about maybe 16 or 17 short stories. Myself and my editor decided that actually there's 12 that really work together. So let's go with that. And so for a while, anyone, I suppose, who's done any kind of list, so let's say even if you do a playlist on YouTube, or a playlist on a tape or whatever, a mixtape, there's always that question of what comes before or after the thing you're choosing. There's always like, well, what order do I put these in? Because there's any number of reasons why you could have this one before or after that one. And this was something that I just could not get my head around at all. And I was like, I was writing list after list after list, and it just wasn't working. I couldn't make any sense of what order to put the stories in. So then I was pretty much this time last year, I woke up one morning and I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll make them into a team. I'll take the 11 players. So there's 11 stories that are told in the first person. So I. And then there's one story told in the third person, which is basically looking off in the distance and talking about other characters as if, you know, in a sort of detached way. So I decided to make the third person story, the coach standing on the sideline, and I decided to make all of the first person stories as like 11 psyches on the pitch. So then I was like, okay. So I said, I'll do a 4-4-2 because that's the formation I played in most when I was younger. And I said, okay, well, which one would be a goalkeeper? And I was like, well, design number 108, he or she, I don't know what the gender of these stories are, but he or she would be a goalkeeper. And then it started becoming very, very clear. I was like, well, half bird, half bear would never be a center half. There's no way he or she would play there. Good winger, probably a left winger. And then I thought, you know, Trusses, solid kind of story, put him in center half, her in center half. I was like, that'll work there. Midfield Dynamo, that seemed very obvious. That had to go into midfield. Prosonecki had to go midfield. I felt that had to as well. Not just because he played midfield, but because of the sort of size of the story, the length of word count and the seriousness, in inverted commas, of the material. So basically, I went around all of these 11 stories, realizing very, very quickly what position they were playing. I mean, I would say if you took 11 of your friends, let's say, and you said, now, if I was to make a team, where would I put them? You'd be able to make those decisions fairly quickly, judging on what their, because there's characteristics that these positions have, you know? So that's how I did it. So then I produced this 11. And then, of course, when it goes into the book, it's obviously just, it goes from start to finish. But I decided, instead of collapsing the team away and showing all of my work and just getting rid of all of my work, I decided to actually, no, I'll show the structure that I came upon, or how I made my decisions. And I left the 442 as the contents page. And then if you turn that page in the book, there's a little schematic. And it's like one of those things you might see on a whiteboard or a trainer's, say, notebook, kind of saying, here's a pattern of play we'll do, or here's what we'll do, you know, to defend, or here's what we'll do to get the ball forward quickly or whatever. So I just decided to kind of do one pattern of play of my own. And that sits on the page after the team layout. And it suggests to the reader one possible pattern for the book, the pattern that I think works. But every reader will have a different pattern. They might just have a very, very straightforward one, or they might have something more complicated. And because there's no page numbers on the team names or on the players' names, it means that I'm not telling you exactly where to go. You have to feel your way into the book. in a certain way. So that's kind of how all that came about. And I remember when I told it to my publisher first, they kind of, their eyebrows raised, you know, for a couple of seconds. They were like, what? And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I think it's the best thing to do. And they're like, and then when they saw it, they were like, actually, it's very handsome. It's very, it looks really nice in the book. The actual layout, the typesetter did a beautiful job of laying out the stories. So that's how that came about. It was mostly just to help me understand the order of the book, and then let other people choose their own order essentially into it, you know.
When you had the stories arranged in their various positions, did you find yourself going back and editing the stories themselves? Did you see anything in the stories that you hadn't seen before you'd ordered them in that way?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So there's an Irish writer called John McGarren who talks about short story collections, and he says that in a novel, it has to stand on its own. So it's its own thing. But in short story collections, the stories can lean on each other a little bit. So, you know, one can lean towards the other. And I realized in that 442 formation, I could understand not only which story was leaning on the other, but also in what direction it was leaning. So when I was then going through the whole book, having made the arrangements, there were little consonances and little things that I pulled out and said, yeah, we'll have, we might repeat that a little later on, or we might actually have that appear in some, or some phrasing might appear. So it was on a very unconscious level that the reader will go, that resonates with something else. I wonder what that was. And they're making, there's little patterns of like a little dinging bell, maybe a little, or a shout from a crowd is just banging away in the background that they go, I heard that somewhere before, or something like that. There are little kind of, I suppose, how would you say, little trace patterns that go through the book that were decided upon when we had agreed on the entirety, on the whole structure. Yeah. So yeah, you're absolutely right to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like the structure is, it's just brilliant. It's just so clever. And it's such an interesting way. I mean, it's great. Obviously, you liked it as a way of ordering the stories and you learn more about your own work in doing so. But it's just such a great way into it as a reader. And even the basic level, like you do give them the proper numbers. Like there's no, they're not listed chronologically. They are listed toward position, which all the football traditionalists will love. I do want to ask you, how did the writing happen for you, Adrian? Because you trained as an engineer, and there will be people listening to this podcast who are doing something that they trained in and they want to chuck it for what effective to work in their passion. So would you have any advice for them in terms of retraining?
Yeah, and I suppose a couple of things to say. When I was working as an engineer, after about a decade of it, I kind of came to the conclusion that I wasn't so connected to the work, you know. And there's lots of different reasons for that. So, but I remember when I finished up on one particular job, and it was a very, very complicated job in Dublin that I'd spent 2 years working on. I remember walking around the building site when it was coming to an end, and all of the structure has been closed over with architectural details that were required, like insulation, all this kind of stuff. And I was going to different parts of the building, just kind of remembering the difficulties that we had in trying to solve certain solutions or certain problems or whatever, certain structural issues. And it was all getting covered over. But I also thought, when I was looking, I was like, any engineer could have done this. And maybe there was something in my ego that this was pricked. I was like, you know, and it's not to say that engineering isn't a very, very good and noble job. It's a very good job to have. It's very interesting as well. But at that time, it just wasn't enough for me, and I didn't feel connected enough, not just to the building, but the actual making of the building, the stuff of it, you know, because structural engineering is a very abstract job in many ways as well, because you're designing very, very large, little, very large numbers. Anyway, so I realized that, and I realized that I wanted, so in 2008, I essentially did two things. I went back to art college in Dunleary, and I started studying up at the Irish Writers' Centre up in Dublin, up in the north side of Dublin, just near the Hugh Lane Gallery. And before this, when I started doing the creative writing courses, one of those tutors, this guy called Greg Baxter, he's an American guy, and he said, I don't want you to plan any of your writing. Ever. Don't plan a word, don't plan a story, don't do anything. And to me, this was very, very strange, because I had spent the last 15 years of my life planning everything in my working life and solving problems in my working life all the time. I think very deductively. But I was like, well, I'm jumping. I'm going to take a leap of faith with this, and I'm not going to plan. I won't plan. Okay. So I started writing without any plan, without any sort of design, or without any sense of where the story was going. And I still do that. I don't plan a single word. When I sit down, I'm just driven by an urge to write something. It could be a color that I see, or an image that I see, or maybe some sort of a sentence. It's just some very small thing that I start with. And if it has energy, I keep going. If it doesn't, I don't. It's It's kind of as simple as that. So when you're not planning stuff, you're exploring essentially, and there's no real right or wrong, and there's no rhyme or reason anyways. So it took me years to make sense of even what I was making myself, because it was coming from the unconscious, I suppose, in many ways. But the really good thing on a practical level in terms of the writing course was that it gave me deadlines, and it gave me some really useful criticism early in my writing. So kind of things that I wouldn't know was bad. Greg would say, this isn't working. This is a massive cliche. You know, you can do better, kind of stuff. And that was very, 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 very helpful to me, because the last time that I'd written creatively before that was probably my Leaving Cert exam, you know? So that early, if I was to say, offer any advice, not that I'm one for advice, but doing a writing course, even an evening course, and just trying it out, and if you like it, and if you like the criticism, and if you like the, do you like just writing a couple of pages of stuff that has never existed before you wrote it? And if that's enough for you, then I think just try it. Yeah, that's all you can do, really. You know?
Let's talk about a couple of your picks. First one, this is the first time this one has been picked. It's the Orbis 1990 World Cup sticker album. Can you tell us a little bit about why you picked this one?
Yeah. Pure nostalgia, obviously, you know. But it was also a brilliant, brilliant book, brilliant thing, you know. So 88 was probably, I was born in 78. So 88 was probably I remember World Cup 86 to a degree. I remember Northern Ireland a little bit, England. Remember Maradona, you know, just bits. I remember Euro 88 pretty vividly, the highs and lows and all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of ready. I was ready to go. And then World Cup 90 came along. And I was fully, fully ready. I was about 11 or 12 by then. I was kind of like very, very into this. So basically, it was a big folder. In many ways, it's kind of like, how should I describe it? It's quite nerdy in many ways, really. So it was just a giant, really glossy and cool looking folder with the word World Cup 90 on it. And Brian Clough, you can see this on YouTube, Brian Clough did the advert for it. And it was like, World Cup 90, I'd look out for it if I were you. It's just like, he's kind of scolding you from the TV to get this stuff. So basically it came in, there were like 20 parts. So every week a new one would come out. And in each part, there were five different sections or six different sections. So one section was sort of player profiles. So you could get a profile of like anyone from, say, Gianluca Vialli, who's still at Hare then, Marco Tardelli, Harry Gregg from Northern Ireland. So it was like quite elastic in terms of time. I think Ronnie Whelan was there as well, and Ruud Gullit, this kind of stuff. So there were like really, really interesting profiles in terms of who they were playing for, who they used to play for, and what their role will be in the national team, this kind of stuff. It's a sort of pattern of looking at footballers that I still do now, you know. So that was the first part. And then the second part was, it also had the sort of teams, the actual teams themselves. So because the book came out before the draw was made, it was just put in alphabetically. So you started with Argentina and whatever, Republic of Ireland was near the end. So basically what you had is you had the first 11, and then you turned the page and you had 9 subs. And I remember the Ireland team, and I remember noticing this myself, erroneously had Liam Brady in the squad, because of course he was dropped from World Cup 90. And there was a few other kind of omissions of this kind as well that you noticed when, by the time the actual World Cup happened. But the really interesting about it thing was that you had to collect the stickers. So my local shop in Ballymahon, Hanley's Newsagents, which is gone now, it's actually a cafe run by a friend of mine now, called Wilder and Gold. But anyway, I used to go in there and buy these stickers. And it soon became, so you get a good chunk of the stickers in, but you're still always way short of all the stickers you needed to finish it. And it soon became apparent to me that these things were sent out in batches from Orbis or whoever the distributor was to these different parts of Ireland, because all of my friends just had the same stickers and we couldn't swap with each other because there was no difference. So then I realized that my grandmother, who's really into football and also had this thing as well, I was like, she lives in Trim, she's going to be getting different batches. So whenever she was coming down to visit us, I'd say, would you bring down your stickers? And so me and my grandmother swapped stickers. And it was really, how would you say, effective, because she had loads of different, she had a different batch. And then I realized, well, look, if this works between Trim and Ballymahon, then between Ballymahon and Dublin, there's going to be even a bigger difference. So I started asking friends, you know, could you bring my mother's friend had children of some areas to me. And I soon realized that if you moved geographically around Ireland, you could actually have a very worthwhile swapping event. In the end, I had to actually just, for my birthday, I had to just buy a load of them from Orbis directly and just send off a list of what I needed. Because I was hell bent on finishing and getting all of the stickers. And I did.
That's, so first of all, congratulations. Also, this has been an incredibly revelatory chat for me, because my first World Cup sticker album was 2002. And we were chatting, listener, about this off air. I too am from Longford, and my mum told you in Ballymahon, and she was sent after school by me to the same newsagents, Hanley's, to get stickers for my O2 World Cup sticker album. And I've never fully understood why I had like 9 Gary Breens and like very few of anyone else. So that's why. And obviously you have the deductive mind that I don't have, and I didn't realize that I should have been importing these stickers from around the country.
That's it, yeah. The geographical, the geopolitics of sticker distribution is a very important thing to keep in mind.
Also, I remember there was in this show, we had someone pick a David Foster Wallace story before, and he talked about how the first time he learned about what adult sadness was when he realized he wouldn't always be a very good tennis player. After being a junior player, he grew up and realized that everyone was better than him. And that, he said, was his introduction to adult sadness. My introduction to adult sadness was Roy Keane being included in that 2002 World Cup sticker album for Ireland, and then obviously not playing at the tournament. So that was my gateway into realizing that the world is not built for us.
Yeah, that's large scale dissonance there. Now you're having to deal with as a young lad. My God, I mean, like I even struggled with Roy Keane not being at that World Cup. But yeah, so that was the World Cup 90 thing, and then there was this other really wonderful. There was like 4 or 5 other sections. One other section was like great games, so like Holland, Argentina in 78, and like the photographs are amazing, all color and really rich film photography and all that kind of stuff, and that sports photography of the time with all of the just different colors and the now pretty dated kind of companies, you know, like Agfa Photo and all that kind of stuff. But then there was one section that was absolutely amazing, and it was called the Golden Goal section. And it was, so there was a sort of 20 different golden goals. And I remember there was 2 of them that were very, very sort of English leaning, and that I took, you know, umbrage with my limited amount of football knowledge at the time. One of them was a not goal. It was Gordon Banks' save against Pele in, I think it was the 70 World Cup, where Gordon Banks pulled off this kind of miraculous save. And it was included in it, even though it wasn't a goal, because it should have been a goal. And the implication was that the English player's goalkeeping brilliance is as good as any goal, which is fair enough. And then the other one, I remember another bone of contention was they tried to claim in this book that actually Maradona's goal was actually last touched by Terry Butcher. So they're trying to forensically unpick this goal, this amazing goal, the great goal that Maradona scored. And they were like, well, actually, it's unlikely he hit it with his right foot. It's more likely Butcher hit it with his right foot in the tackle. And I remember being, this is outrageous. I was like, it was my first view of like actual propaganda, you know? No one, but obviously it's absolute, absolute nonsense. And then, but the one that I remember most vividly was the very first one in the great goals. And it was the Scottish player, Archie Gemmell's goal against Holland. I think it was in 78. I can't remember. Maybe it was 82. Can't remember. But basically what you had was, you had a kind of a plan view of the thing. So you had like a dotted line for dribbling, and you had like a continuous line for shot or for pass. And so it was shown in this kind of variety of views. So like, you know, the plan view, and then you had a kind of a photograph, and then you had a kind of a sort of isometric view of the players coming across to try and take the ball off Archie Gemmell, bald Archie Gemmell. And so you were trying to piece it together, but because there was no YouTube then or anything like that, you just kind of had to go, yeah, I think I know what happened, but I'm not really sure, but I think I get it. And it is great. And then, or it was only then later in the 90s, say 96, 97, when the film Trainspotting came out, and I went to see it in the cinema. And I was living in Scotland, Aberdeen at the time. And there's this amazing scene where, you know, where Renton is with the Kelly MacDonald character, and they're making love essentially. And in the background, they have a video stolen from a friend's house of them having made a sex video. And in the other friend's house, this is all wonderfully split together in the Danny Boyle film. There's the other couple getting it on. But instead of them watching their own video of them getting it on, there is Archie Gemmell's goal against Holland. And in this kind of weird, kind of beautifully edited and really kind of emotionally big moment in the film, I realize this is the first time I'm actually seeing Archie Gemmell's goal in its actuality. That kind of really brilliant sex scene in Trainspotting is not momentous for me for any of the actual lovemaking, but the actual that I got to see this strangely still version of the goal that I'd wondered over for years. Yeah.
So, Adrian, this is episode 71 of this show. Up to now, in the 70 episodes, I've managed to get away without revealing that I've not read Fighter, which is Andy Lee's autobiography that is co-written by the 42's deputy editor, Niall Kelly, who will be listening to this show. So that has now come out in the wash. So tell us about the book and why you picked it.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, in the last couple of years, I've kind of... I've gone back. So like there would have been like from my early 30s to mid 30s, I'd sort of lost touch with sport as something that I was really ritualistically interested in. I think largely because I changed direction in life, in terms of I was just so obsessed with art and writing and that I'd lost touch with sport. So now in the last couple of years, now that I'm kind of a little bit more settled into what I do, I've reconnected considerably with sport again. I watch a lot of sport again, golf, football, all the rest. But in that time, I developed a sort of an interest in boxing that I didn't actually have when I was younger. So I came across Andy Lee about maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I'd heard of him. I'd obviously knew his name because he's pretty famous in Ireland, but I didn't really register his achievements as a boxer or anything like that. And I didn't really follow him as a boxer when he was boxing. And that sounds crazy thing to say, because he was such a rightly adored figure in the boxing scene in Ireland. So where I came across him was, on a sports radio, when he'd be talking on the radio or he'd be talking on different programs. And I was just over time like, who is this really interesting guy called Andy Lee, who's like always says something extremely interesting every time he's on? So I just started looking into it, and then I was like, oh right, he was actually a boxer. And then I kind of go, oh yeah, I kind of remember him now. So then I started kind of researching his career as a boxer, and I was looking at all of his fights and all this kind of stuff, and researching some of his brilliant punditry as well. And I was like, wow, this guy's super interesting. And then last year I bought the book Fighter during lockdown, Andy Lee Fighter, which Niall Ghost wrote. And I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. I really, really enjoyed pretty much every aspect of it. I thought it was brilliantly, brilliantly written and really, really excitingly kind of structured. I really, really, really enjoyed it as a work of kind of literature. But also it allowed Andy's voice to appear really, really clearly, really, really often. And I really admire that kind of I suppose you call it humility in a ghostwriter, to allow actually the voice of the subject of the biography to appear. And what I really enjoyed was that the actual sport writing, the placing of you as a reader into the position of Andy when he's actually looking at boxing, or that he's entering a ring, or he's transforming from Andy into the boxer, Andy Lee. I found all of that stuff really compelling, but then I really found utterly compelling the sort of, not just the relationships he has in and outside the ring, but his philosophy on boxing and on, so he would talk in general terms in a really, really clear way. And then he'd go in for these extraordinary details, like, you know, say using coconut oil instead of Vaseline, all these kind of like really, really interesting details that also sort of gave you a view into his personality and what's important to him. And I just thought all of this carried on with really kind of with such ease and such clarity. And it was just so, so interesting because I know nothing about boxing, but I felt like I learned something about boxing, but also about the industry of boxing and the kind of murkiness of that industry as well. And also like the idea that at every millisecond in a boxing match, you're making life decisions. This is what Andy says. And I just found that absolutely astonishing. So it was all of those aspects that I really, really enjoyed. And at the time, at the same time, I was reading this other book called Memoirs of Hadrian, which is this wonderful book written in 1951, you obviously way back, by a Belgian writer called Marguerite Yourcenar. And she writes it from the view of Emperor Hadrian back in the whatever second century. And because I was reading these two books at the same time, I started kind of imagining Andy's time in the US, working his way up as a boxer, as like a kind of a Roman Empire being built, you know? And I started kind of conflating sort of Emperor Hadrian with Andy. And it was just produced these extraordinary vistas and moments of illumination and moments of conflict. And it just, the whole thing became really heightened and strange. And then I just kind of read this bit in Yourcenar's book where she talks about the antique melancholy of that period of time. So it was sort of it was when all the gods were coming to an end, this period of time, Roman history, when the gods were sort of receding and Christ was yet to come into view, that there was a sort of void and that man was alone on the planet, you know? And I started sort of thinking that that antique melancholy must exist for a moment in a boxer's mind or body when the ref falls away and the team fall away and the bell goes and you're confronted with this other entity who shares presumably a similar melancholy, but that is also a sort of physical and existential threat within a kind of confined space. And I started making these kind of really enjoyable conflations between the two, Niall's writing and Marguerite Yourcenar's and Andy's thoughts and Emperor Hadrian's thoughts. And it just produced this, maybe it was a lockdown fever, but it produced this really strange and really rich kind of swirling world that I felt I understood. But of course, you know, you can only understand as much as the words can give you. So
yeah, that's a gorgeous idea. What antique melancholy is that? Yeah, antique with a Q-U-E at the end.
Melancholy. Yeah. And it's just, I think it was Flaubert used the term, but he was talking about that time when the gods receded and Christ was yet to appear. And that there was just this void where man was alone. And I just thought that there's something very, very evocative in that. And it was just by chance, I happened to be reading the Andy Lee book at the same time, but I would read, because the days were long, I just read one and then I'd read the other and then read one, read the other. So they're just, they kind of sit together as two books. It's probably a strange, but maybe it's a strange company, but it makes total sense to me. And I enjoyed it greatly. But getting back to the Andy Lee book, I mean, the other thing about it was like, just the passages where he talks about this transformation that he goes through and how he talks about him in the ring as being spiteful and nasty and cruel and all this kind of stuff. And I just, the candor of it all and the clarity, I was completely blown away by it. I found, in as much as I enjoyed the way in which Marguerite Yourcenar embodied Hadrian, I really, really enjoyed the way I could sort of understand and get a kind of a sense of embodiment from Fighter as well. It had that kind of strength. They're obviously very different things, but there were constances for me outside of just me reading at the same time that I really enjoyed it. Yeah, brilliant book.
That's brilliant. We're turning for home. We have two questions we throw at everyone as a kind of a structured crescendo to the podcast. I don't know if our listeners like the questions or not. I know the guests absolutely hate them. So best of luck with these. We always ask the most interesting place that you've been with work. So you don't like, I mean, take that whatever way you want to take it. And doesn't necessarily have to be your work as a writer either, to be honest.
Yeah, no, interesting places work. Yeah, well, I mean, I think I can answer that fairly easily. It was a place I was in a couple of years ago. I was working on my second novel, A Sabbatical in Leipzig, which came out last year, and which I thought had disappeared. But then it got shortlisted for a book award, so I'm really happy about all of that. But anyway, even though it's called A Sabbatical in Leipzig, it actually takes place in Bilbao, most of it, in northern Spain or Basque region. So when I was writing the book, about two-thirds of the way through writing the book, I realized that I actually needed to go to Bilbao to kind of try and finish the book. So I went to Bilbao, and the book is told through a 70-year-old retired engineer who's Irish. So I went to Bilbao and I decided that I would walk around Bilbao and be in Bilbao as if I were a 70-year-old man. And that was really strange because there's obviously certain hills you can't go up and there's certain cafes you would go into and certain cafes you wouldn't go into. And then there were certain bridges and certain buildings that he'd be utterly interested in. So Bilbao then became, for the 4 days that I was working there, being this other person, became absolutely fascinating. I absolutely loved it. It was an amazing place. So I'm really looking forward to going back there just as myself and not having to kind of extract stuff or sort of negotiate it as something that might appear in a book. So Bilbao, I'd say, it would be one of the most interesting places I've been, yeah.
Did you go full Daniel Day-Lewis on the 70-year-old man? Are you walking with a stoop? Did you bring a stick? Did you get any kind of bus pass? How did that work?
No, I was just inordinately grumpy to everyone. I don't know. It was just like, what would he find interesting? That was kind of it. Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed it. It was good fun. And I actually ended up quite liking him. He's a nice old guy, whoever the hell he is, you know. But I suppose now you say it, it is a little bit kind of method acting. I suppose it is a little bit like that. Yeah, yeah.
And finally, Adrian, the most interesting person that you've met with work or through work?
Oh, God, that's so hard to ask. That's so hard to answer. That's a really, really, really difficult question to answer because everyone is so interesting, you know. Like, I have this view that that the category that we use, like, say, categories like male or female or human, I think these categories are, they're enacted far too early on life. And that actually everyone is actually an alien. You know, everyone is completely unknowable and is completely difficult to understand and completely strange. As if there were aliens from different planets, you know, only they just happen to be on this planet at the same time as me. So I find everyone completely fascinating on that level. Like, everyone is completely fascinating. Even if they might be, you know, a bit dull to talk to, there's still something completely unknowable about everybody. And I think that fascination of just looking at people that I do know and that I don't know, that to me is enough for me to sidestep answering your impossibly difficult question. So my answer would have to be that I find everyone pretty much utterly, utterly, utterly fascinating, like completely. I could think of my mother, I could think of my brother, you know, whatever. all fascinating in their own way, you know.
That is as adroit an answer. No, it's as adroit an answer as we've had to that question. That's absolutely perfect. Midfield Dynamo, it's published by Lilliput Press. It's out now. Adrian Duncan, thanks so much. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot to Adrian, and thanks as ever to you for listening to Behind the Lines and supporting the 42. It is greatly appreciated. We are going to be back next week with another great guest here on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.